It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. $300 million is all that separates the Senate and House budgets. It's a lot of money, to be sure. However, in the context of state budgets totaling about $11 billion, it might not seem an insurmountable difference. But to listen to the rhetoric this week, you'd think that the two legislative bodies were worlds apart. Governor Maggie Hassan has sharply criticized the Senate's budget as fiscally irresponsible, saying it puts at risk critical services and undermines efforts to strengthen our economy. While Senate President Peter Bragdon this week replied that the governor has zero credibility when it comes to budgeting, given what he called her own abysmal record on spending as a former state senator. All in all, it's not the most positive backdrop as House and Senate budget negotiations begin, but by law, they have to work it out and do it soon. The new fiscal year begins in about 3 weeks. Outside of these political wins at the State House, there was some blowback to wind farms in New Hampshire this week as one proposal was rejected and another revised. And that rumbling noise you might start hearing this weekend, don't worry, it's just the start of a 90-year Granite State tradition as Bike Week kicks off tomorrow in Laconia. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and let's hear from you. As we catch up on the news of the week, what stories do you think are the most important? What news items caught your attention this week? And what questions, comments, or concerns do you have about it? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. And you can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Our guests for the roundtable this week are Kevin Landrigan, longtime political reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua. Kevin, it's been a busy week. I appreciate you taking some time out.
Great to be back, Laura.
Also with us, Dan Tuohy, state editor for Patch.com. Patch is a New Hampshire news source with 12 websites in New Hampshire. And Dan Tuohy, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the popular website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, welcome back. Thanks for your time.
Hi, good morning, Laura.
Well, gentlemen, before we get into all the New Hampshire news, and boy, there's a lot to look at, let's just look nationally for a moment. We just heard that report about the unemployment numbers, 175,000 new jobs created in May, but the unemployment rate edged up to 7.6 from 7.5. Dean Spiliotis, to first, please. How does this relate to New Hampshire?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think just as a general statement, I think the administration will at least be happy that we had an increase in 175,000 jobs. Typically, in order to bring the unemployment rate down over a sustained period of time, you want closer to 250,000 jobs per month. But I think they'll take the 175. Also, even though the number ticked up a teeny bit, the argument is that there are more people looking for work now, which is a good sign. You know, one of the conservative critiques of the drop in unemployment in recent years has been that, well, it's dropping because people are becoming dispirited and dropping out of the workforce. So to the extent that the administration can show that more people are looking for jobs, even if it ticks up a little bit, that's probably a good thing. And I think the 175 thousand jobs, they'll be reasonably happy about that. You know, New Hampshire has typically done better than national average. We're down around 5.2% right now. I think the new numbers come out in a couple of weeks. So we've been a little bit insulated from sort of the brunt of the recession that we've come out of. But, you know, I think it's in general, it's good news overall. It means more people will be taking vacations up here. More people will be buying consumable goods. And so overall, probably pretty good news. I think they would probably, again, rather see upwards of, you know, 250,000 new jobs over a sustained period of time. But to the extent that more people are looking for work and consumer confidence is up, that's a good thing.
Yeah, and I appreciate your point, Dean, about New Hampshire's numbers not quite out yet. Sometimes, Kevin, when we report on the national numbers, people say, well, why aren't you telling us what's happening in New Hampshire? There's a lag there.
There is. It usually takes a couple of weeks for the Bureau of Labor Market Statistics here in New Hampshire. For all states, really. Some states are quicker than others. States like New York and California usually do it in about a week. It takes us about 2 weeks. These numbers will be interesting for New Hampshire, really, because as Dean was talking about the national picture, that hasn't quite been the New Hampshire picture, and here's why. Both in March and April, the labor force in New Hampshire actually contracted. It was really by small amounts, but it ended about a year of labor force growth in New Hampshire and was one of the things that was driving New Hampshire's unemployment rate much lower than the national rate. Now, as Dean points out, and I suspect this is true, summer is the hiring season in New Hampshire. With tourism being such a driving force of our economy, I fully expect the labor force to now grow and expand and go over 700,000 in New Hampshire and probably lead to an even lower unemployment rate by Labor Day.
All right. And Dan Tuohy, to you, what's your Granite State take on these numbers?
Well, as Kevin mentioned, and Dean as well, it's 5.2% unemployment in New Hampshire, give or take a percentage point. We're talking about 40,000 people that are unemployed.
It's interesting. 5.2 sounds pretty good. 40,000 doesn't sound so good.
Exactly.
I mean, that's a lot of people.
You realize that there are real people here behind these numbers. You know, as Kevin mentioned, the tourism season, we're in right now, and the construction season. I mean, you drive around the state and look at some of these construction crews, local and state. They're out there in force, and that'll show up in the numbers as well.
Well, speaking of numbers, let's turn to the Statehouse, gentlemen. Lots of number crunching over there, and I'd love your help sorting through it. The big news now, as you all know, is that we've got three budgets. We had the governor's much earlier this year, the House's earlier this spring, and now we've got the Senate's. They just voted on it yesterday. Yes, there are some differences, Kevin Landrigan, but, you know, $300 million is all that separates the House and Senate version. Why is the rhetoric so heated about this? You know, when you've got a budget of about $11 billion, $300 million doesn't sound like that much.
No, it doesn't. I mean, in almost an $11 billion budget, the Senate's budget is $10.7 billion. And as we talked about before the opening here off air, about $200 million of that $300 million difference is really an argument about how much a tax is going to be generated from hospitals that actually just gets sent back to hospitals in uncompensated care payments. The Senate is very forceful that it believes the governor and the House have grossly overestimated how much hospitals are going to pay that tax. As you know, this year, hospitals are expected to pay $30 million less than we thought they were going to pay. So there's a lot. There's a lot to argue about. We have divided government here, and you're seeing that with Republicans in the Senate being critical of those revenue estimates and also some of the spending priorities. But and we'll talk a lot about the differences, such as the expansion of Medicaid probably is the single biggest difference here. But here's the reason why there are a lot of similarities between all these budgets is there's no longer former House Speaker Bill O'Brien for the Senate to use as the foil. People will remember here, Dan certainly will, 2 years ago, the Senate Republicans that had 19 Republicans and only 5 Democrats, nonetheless, were perfectly happy to play the good cop to Bill O'Brien's bad cop as he led to an historic 11% reduction in state spending in this current budget. So Senate Republicans now, with only 13 in number, and looking at a 2014 election that right now is not really trending for Republicans very well, are very fearful of looking like the budget ogre as the slash and burner. So that's one of the reasons why in this Senate budget you see a lot of, yeah, me too, whether it's university system spending. Yeah, I'm for that. How about mental health, the $24 million in additional spending? Sure, we'll do that. Eliminating the waiting list for the developmentally impaired. The Senate says, me too with that as well. Adds money back to LCHIP and for substance abuse, even more than what the House
does. Well, and LCHIP has typically been something that, you know, gets cut first.
Right, because people over trees, you remember that whole debate that Republicans have always had about LCHIP. But nonetheless, they found a little extra money there. That's the different dynamic here this time.
Well, and picking up what you said, Kevin, to you, Dean. Okay, so a lot of people would agree with Kevin. Last year, Senate President Peter Bagdon was seen as the good cop to Bill O'Brien's bad cop. But this week, Senate President Bagdon had some pretty harsh words for Governor Hassan, saying, you know, what does she know about budgeting? Her record was, quote, abysmal as a state senator. Were you surprised by that level of rhetoric from the seemingly affable Senate president?
Well, I think, you know, at this point in the legislative season, tempers are running a little bit short. And I think everybody's, you know, whether it's casino gambling or the Medicaid expansion or some of the other revenue issues like the cigarette tax and the gas tax, you know, I think at this point everybody's kind of ready to wrap this up. Yeah, Peter Bragdon was responding to some earlier comments by Governor Hassan. The Senate in their budget asked the governor to make, I think it's $50 million in across-the-board cuts without specifying where those cuts should be. And she basically said that was a bit of a cop-out, that they needed to actually, you know, say what they wanted to cut. If they were not going to give the House the revenue enhancements that the House wanted and that the governor wanted, they had to explain where they're going to cut that money. And they just said, we're going to leave it up to you to figure out where this $50 million and across-the-board cuts should come. And so she responded by saying that, you know, that this was kind of a fiscal – this was sort of political he responded by saying that Governor Hassan's own record as a state senator was abysmal fiscally and that this was political gamesmanship. So, you know, I just think at this point, I think the larger point than Kevin made is a good one. The reality is there's still a lot of increased spending in this bill. It's not a huge amount of money, even despite some of the high-profile differences over casino gambling and now this Medicaid expansion issue that seems to be blowing up. Maybe a little uncharacteristic for Peter Bragdon, but in the grand scheme of what of how this session differs in comparison to the O'Brien legislature, you know, probably something that will blow over pretty quickly.
Dan, how is the average person supposed to figure this out? I mean, again, Governor Hassan says, you know, across the board cuts, devastating. The state employees union says it could mean up to 700 jobs lost, which, you know, in the current unemployment concerns, 700 jobs lost sounds like a lot. And then you do hear the Senate saying, look, it's not that different. It's only $300 million, and this is an exaggeration. How is the average person supposed to figure this out?
With a scorecard.
Yeah.
And the thing is, this is fluid. It's even though the House and the Senate now have their own versions of the budget, they're very different, as we know. They're going to come together and negotiate, and the governor in the governor's office will be part of that discussion, likely starting next week or the week after. But really, this budget, and one thing that as reporters and the press and people in general, we look at where they're different. But where they're similar, right from when the governor proposed, no new taxes, no income tax, no sales tax. Some of these similarities will help hopefully get them to the finish line. As Chuck Morris mentioned, it's a modest 3% increase in the budget. Also, the Senate stripped that 12-cent gas tax increase from the House version. They removed the 20-cent cigarette tax increase. So he has some of these, again, policy arguments that we're getting at that really, you know, it's almost like tit for tat between the two chambers where, you know, Kevin and I were talking about this earlier, where if they kill one bill that's a pet project of the House and there's some, you know, retribution going on there, and if that keeps going on, maybe Kevin expand on that later.
All right. After a short break, hold off on that thought. And we'll take your calls, too. The exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. As we catch up on the news of the week, what are some of the stories that you think are the most important or that you just want to know more about? Call in 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Want to join the exchange team? Well, the Barber and Dick Couch Fellowship is your opportunity. NHPR is looking for a recent college graduate savvy with social media and eager for hands-on experience with New Hampshire's signature statewide talk show. Apply today at nhpr.org. More of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on the exchange at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. It's the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, offering tune-ups, repairs, and efficient air conditioning systems, including ductless AC, for homes without ductwork, online at justcallheritage.com. From Sulloway & Hollis, providing legal solutions and effective advocacy for healthcare organizations and professionals, schools, and businesses throughout New Hampshire. And the Bank of New Hampshire Pavilion at Meadowbrook in Guilford, presenting the Avid Brothers and Old Crow Medicine Show, June 8th at 7:30. Tickets at banknhpavilion.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup of the top stories that Granite Staters were talking about this week. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. What news items caught your attention this week? What questions, comments, or concerns do you have about it? The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Our guests for the roundup this week are Kevin Landrigan with the Telegraph of Nashua, Dean Spiliotis with the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, and Dan Tuohy, State Editor for Patch. NHPR.com. And all of you, before we go to our listeners, a little bit more of the budgetary stuff, if you could help us wade through that. And Dean, to you first, boy, this week, if you could summarize the news besides the budget, it would be Medicaid, 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 Medicaid. This is a real sticking point. The Senate doesn't want New Hampshire to go along with expanded Medicaid as envisioned by the Affordable Care Act. The House and governor do. This is a big decision. You know, whatever is decided, it puts the state on one clear path or the other. Just put this in the larger context for us, Dean, and then we'll talk more specifically about the state.
Sure. I mean, this is an issue that is blowing up not only in New Hampshire, but around the entire country. You may remember that the when the Supreme Court issued its decision on Obamacare, one of the things that they said in the decision was that states should have the right to opt out of the Medicaid expansion. So for here in New Hampshire, we're talking about roughly, I think it's is it $3.5 or $2.5 billion over 7 years. I think for the next year, it's roughly $340,000. So it's a significant amount of money. And we've seen in a number of states a sort of really interesting dynamic. You know, for example, in Arizona, their very conservative Governor Jan Brewer wants the money, but the Republican legislature does not, and she has vetoed as sort of punishment four or five other unrelated pieces of legislation to kind of pressure the legislature. In Florida, Governor Rick Scott, who ran in opposition to Obamacare, then decided to take the money, now had his legislature say, no, we're not going to take the money, similar to what's happening here in the Senate. So this is becoming a real bone of a contention, both between parties and within the Republican Party in particular. There's a real division about whether or not to take this money. You know, here in New Hampshire, it really does seem to sort of be gaining speed. And I think what you're going to see is, over the next few weeks, supporters of the expansion try to concretize what the loss of money would mean, both in terms of the impact on women, other sorts of disadvantaged individuals, to try to kind of put a face on the loss of that income. We're talking about, I think, roughly 58,000 additional people getting insurance coverage as a result. So this has become a very big issue. Again, Governor Hassan has not said whether or not she will veto a bill that doesn't include it, but I think this is going to be a big part of the conference negotiation.
Yeah, it's huge. I'd love your thoughts, too, on this, Dan. What are you hearing?
Well, I covered Peter Bragdon. He was in his home district on Monday talking about similar things he said on the floor. The Senate president, of course, took to the floor yesterday to argue the defeat of that amendment to add or to expand Medicaid. And he was bringing up the same Republican argument that, look, we can't trust the federal government. They have a staggering debt. The money, where's the money going to come from? You know, this Medicaid expansion, is it going to be like special education, which is that promise that the feds would fully fund that? Look, the feds fell down there. Why should we trust them? And on the other side, of course, you have the Democrats pointing out that, look, you know, this is an opt-in. We can opt out. Even though the Senate president doesn't believe that, right, Kevin?
That's right.
Well, and there are some questions as to whether states can do that, opt in and opt out. But I know that's being talked about in other states. So, yeah. Yes. Go ahead with Peter Bragdon. So what else did he say when you covered him this week?
Well, he was saying, like, he is not about ideology, he was saying. And, you know, he's focused on the facts. You know, let's come to the facts. And again, similar to what Peter Bragdon said yesterday and then Monday in his home district, you know, Jed Bradley, the Senate majority leader, went to the same effect saying, We're not saying no, we're saying just not right now.
And that I want to – oh, go ahead. I'm
right.
Sorry, Dan.
So if it may not be jump into Medicaid expansion this year, perhaps next year. But the key here is this first entry, the feds have a 100% payment rate.
Right, 100% for the first three years. And
yes.
Then 90% thereafter. And Kevin, I'd love your take on this too. Boy, just listening to it go back and forth, this is a big decision for New Hampshire, and it's hard to figure out what the right way might be.
Yeah, it is a real big decision. And Governor Hassan points to Republican governors who have taken the money, like Jan Brewer and like Chris Christie in New Jersey is another example. But it's kind of important to keep in mind that a lot of this debate really is about the Affordable Care Act. And there's a lot of pressure on Republicans here in New Hampshire and across the country to resist confirming or ratifying anything about the Affordable Care Act. Now, New Hampshire becomes even more important right now because going back to the scorecard that Dan mentioned, the scorecard says 23 states have said yes, we're expanding Medicaid. 20 states have said no. New Hampshire is one of 8 states that is not decided. And it's important to point out, Senate President Bragdon has stressed, I'm not blocking expanded Medicaid. I want to create a bipartisan commission. They'd issue a report by December to study it. But so much of this, I believe, is about money. And it's really not about the taxpayers' money. It's about my money. With only 8 states still in play, you've got a lot of very conservative Republican financial supporters, folks like the Koch brothers, Karl Rove, and others, saying to New Hampshire Republicans, if you hold out on expanding Medicaid, we will make it rain for your reelection in 2014. Now, going back to what I was talking about earlier, looking like a pretty popular Governor Hassan at the top of the ballot with a fairly popular Senator Gene Shaheen right there as well. With only 13 Republicans, they may need some financial cover in order to hang on. It's important also to note that this opt-in, opt-out really was created by a Supreme Court decision. The Supreme Court essentially said Obamacare may not force states to expand Medicaid. It did not say here's how states have to opt in or how they have to opt out.
It's unclear, isn't
it? It's very unclear, and that's why the legal beagles really on both sides of this debate now really going through all kinds of statements by governors in other states about what authorities they thought they may or may not have had to executively opt in or opt out. And certainly Governor Hassan has said it appears I have to work and collaborate in order to make this happen.
With the legislature.
That does not say it appears I have to get the permission of the legislature to expand Medicaid. So,
wow, you've got to parse those words, don't you? And we did a program on this issue about a week ago. We had 4 guests in here, 2 in favor, 2 opposed. And I asked them about the opt-out. And I believe even the people who were opposed to Medicaid expansion said, yes, you might be able to opt out technically, but you know, who's going to do that? Who's going to pull health insurance from, you know, X tens of thousands of people? Dan Tuohy, Dean Spiliotis, and then I've got an email I want to share with you folks.
Yes, just a quick addendum. We talked about the economy earlier. Sylvia Larson was on the Senate floor yesterday, and she was saying this Medicaid expansion is also an economic benefit, not just to the individuals who would be helped, but it has the potential, she was saying, to add 5,100 new jobs, presumably in the healthcare industry. That, you know, and I think other members of the Democratic caucus said the same thing. Like, this is, and we all know healthcare decisions can be costly. This is going to be an extra booster shot for the New Hampshire economy.
Well, and one last question for you. And Dean, go ahead and jump in, and then I want to ask Kevin one more question.
I think it's important to underscore the political point that Kevin raised at the beginning of his comments. You know, for a long time, conservatives and opponents of Obamacare were pinning their hopes on the Roberts Court, that they were just basically going to sink this law. It didn't happen. The Medicaid expansion is one of the few areas where there's some wiggle room. And I think the strategy you're seeing now among Republicans nationally is to make the rollout of Obamacare as problematic and as difficult as possible so that Congress will be forced to kind of go back and at least take back or modify parts of it. That's the strategy now. It's basically, in some cases, blocking implementation. In other cases, whether it's taking this $5 million to educate people about the health exchanges, we're seeing this sort of larger kind of semi-coordinated effort, but also partially independent within states, of conservatives who basically want to scuttle this as much as possible. But the reality is it's coming in the next year or two. And so we're having these kinds of pitched battles now over the implementation.
Well, and here's my last question. Speaking of wiggle room, Dean Spiliotis, Kevin, to you, Senate President Peter Bragdon just yesterday seemed to leave a little crack in the door to possible agreement on this very tough issue of Medicaid expansion.
He did. He, during his remarks on the floor during a 90-minute debate, the biggest debate on the budget, and the House Chief Budget Writer, Mary Jane Wallner, by the way, has said Medicaid expansion is the 800-pound gorilla in the room in the budget negotiations. Senate President Peter Bragdon essentially said, I'm open to discussion over the next several weeks. As Dan pointed out, he's taken that kind of listening posture about it. He also said maybe there is a New Hampshire solution. We certainly saw in the state of Maine something interesting yesterday. The Maine Senate approved expanding Medicaid, but put a kill switch on it after 3 years.
That's what people are looking at.
Which essentially something like that would certainly empower the Republicans to say, we don't trust this. Let's see how it works and shut it down unless it works really well and we agree to reaffirm it.
Although on our panel, again, the Republicans on that panel said, yeah, maybe in theory you could do that, but boy, that would be tough to do. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange. We're looking at some of the top stories of the week. We want to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Again, email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Here's an email from Eric in Andover. He said, I was disappointed to see House leadership attach part of the Affordable Care Act to a Senate-supported bill that deals with renewable energy. The House wants the Affordable Care Act. The Senate wants renewable energy legislation to support wood-to-energy power plants. So lots of partisan leveraging, strategizing going on, holding hostage good bills with bipartisan support to score political points. Not surprising, but disappointing nonetheless, says our emailer, Eric. Kevin wrote about this actually in an article. I think he called it Night of the Living Dead, reviving bills, getting killed, and back and forth. Does this happen all the time, Dean, or is it especially bad this year? Thanks for the email, Eric.
This is a pretty common strategy. The idea is that if first you don't succeed with your bill, attach it to an unrelated piece of legislation that the other side wants and see if you can cut some sort of a deal. We've seen this on a number of occasions this year. It's part of the legislative process. It's part of the strategy. It has a very mixed record of success. It often results in basically everything being kind of scuttled because people on each side don't want the other side to get what they want. We see it at the national level all the time, often with very controversial amendments that get attached to, you know, Republicans may have an amendment that's very controversial to Democrats, so they attach it to something that's very important to Democrats and vice versa. And we've seen a number of this type of examples of this sort of gamesmanship, you know, here in the state recently, just over the last week as well, trying to revive bills that have been taken down by attaching them to pieces of legislation that then either go to the conference or in some cases go to the other chamber.
Yeah, Kevin.
Yeah, that's what happened actually this week. On Wednesday, House Speaker Tarantarelli was really happy that the House was able to complete all of its work and get the bills it wanted to conference committees and essentially said to the House, great job, you're not coming in next week. Now, let's go back to elementary school and remember. what happened when the I know Laura was a really good girl at school, but Dan, what happened when the substitute teacher left the classroom? The first thought we all had was, let's ransack it, right? And that's what happened in the Senate last night as sundown was approaching. They knew if we attach all failed bills that the Senate passed and the House killed, the House isn't in next session. They all have to go to a conference committee. They all get a second life. They're all Night of the Living Dead bills, as these all were.
Well, after covering New Hampshire news for a long time, I'm starting to get either a Groundhog Day or a Night of the Living Dead feeling, because nothing ever really dies in the legislature, Kevin. It just comes back for another time.
No, it's true. And it is kind of, it's to me, it's kind of one of the endearing qualities of the New Hampshire legislature is that in so many states and having covered Massachusetts politics for 8 years, it's impossible to pass bills in most states. It's really hard to definitively kill bills here. I remember in Massachusetts, there was a famous committee chairman who basically told lobbyists it cost $20,000 to get a hearing on a bill in my committee. Not to get a vote from the committee, just to get a hearing. Here, every bill gets a hearing, every bill gets a vote, and every bill is not dead until the gavel is brought down, ending the session.
And then it might come back next session.
That's true.
The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Eric, thanks again for that email. The email address for you to join us, exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. This week, Dan Toohey, Governor Hassan nominated yet another new commissioner to be part of her team, Jim Craig, to be her labor commissioner, especially timely today since we talked about those national unemployment numbers. Just remind us, Dan, please, who Jim Craig is. It's a familiar name to some Statehouse watchers.
Absolutely. He's an attorney from Manchester. He's a former Democratic state rep from Manchester. He ran for Congress unsuccessfully. I think a lot of people know him as a reasonable, sensible person who knows the economy well, and he knows the strengths. He probably knows the weaknesses too of this economy, and we'll see. I think the council will look favorably upon that nomination.
Yeah, the executive council you're talking about has to approve this nomination.
Correct.
And no murmurings about, you know, they don't like this nominee.
I haven't heard any yet.
Yeah. And just remind us, Dan, you know, most people are familiar with the Health and Human Services Commissioner or the Transportation Commissioner or maybe the Corrections Commissioner. Labor Commissioner, how important a job is that?
I think it's a tremendously important job. You've seen some very important people in that position before. You're right. You see like these names on paychecks and whatnot. You see going to an elevator, you see some of these names on the certificate. Like, oh, who is that person? they're real people that punch a clock in Concord every day. And
Kevin?
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting about labor is that almost its entire $9 million budget comes from federal funds or from fees paid by employers to support regulation, which we're fond of doing here in New Hampshire. Rather than raising taxes, we make the source of our regulation pay for that regulation, and that happens in labor. As a result, it's a political appointment. I mean, a lot of former legislators in both parties have served as labor commissioner. A lot of people who are active in the organized labor movement have been labor commissioners as well. Jim Craig, however, really is an excellent choice on a lot of levels. One, it gives Democrats to cheer about, and after supporting Roger Savini, Craig Benson's insurance commissioner, for another term, after naming Jeff Rose, a former aide to ex-Congressman, Republican Congressman Jeb Bradley, Democrats were looking for one of their own. It's also important right now because, as we've talked about throughout this show right now, Maggie Hassan badly needs the House. She needs them to be the firewall supporting Medicaid expansion, supporting spending that isn't in the Senate budget, supporting a number of the priority bills that they have. Jim Craig is an exceptionally popular former legislator, poker player, great sense of humor, really friendly with Republicans when he was the House Democratic leaders. In the years the Republicans dominated the legislature, he always had a very folksy way about him, an aw shucks way about him that was really endearing to Republicans, and I think he'll be an effective advocate for her at the State House.
Now, that's really interesting because to the average person, including me, I think, oh, this guy Jim Craig, okay, former Democrat, appointed labor commissioner, and, you know, it's not one of those big department heads that you hear about. But here you are, Kevin, explaining to us that this is really important to make the House Democrats feel good, given that they've been sort of beaten down by this budgetary process, or feeling beaten down anyway.
Right. And as we saw, there was some real tension between the governor and the House over the casino.
Sure.
She really wanted it. The House leadership really didn't. And ultimately, the House killed that casino bill. Some bruised egos, I think, on both sides from all of that. This papers all of that over.
All right. Well, the number for you to join us after a short break is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Coming up, we're going to check in quickly with the kickoff of Bike Week in Laconia coming this weekend. And also we'll talk a little bit about some blowback toward wind farms here in New Hampshire. All that plus your calls at 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and the Mood Disorder Service at Dartmouth, advancing research in treatment-resistant depression on the web at mood.dartmouth.edu. And the Scott Lawson Companies, protecting your company's most valuable asset, your people, through workers' comp, wellness, and health and safety services, healthierworkers.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
NHPR counts on listener support to keep you informed about important issues and events in New Hampshire, across the country, and around the world. When you make a contribution before our short June drive, you become a part of our daily broadcast. Plus, you'll be automatically entered to win our two drawing prizes, an overnight trip to Tanglewood to see Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and a five-night trip to Lisbon, Portugal. Make your gift at 1-888-805-NHPR or at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're catching up on all the big stories that Granite Staters were talking this week. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. What news items from the week caught your attention? Which ones do you think are the most important? What questions, comments, concerns do you have about that headline? 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Kevin Landrigan, Dean Spiliotis, Dan Tuohy, big news in the Lakes region this week with the opening of Bike Week starting tomorrow in Laconia. With us now for more on that is John Cudgel. He's a reporter for the Laconia Citizen. John, thanks a lot for your time.
Laura.
So what's it like there, John? Is the city getting all ready and waiting for the 90th Bike Week?
Then the city is ready. It's a little rainy, overcast here today, but the city's been getting ready since about December. And what happens is that we have what we call a motorcycle technical review committee, which actually begins reviews of property owners who want to use their properties for Bike Week events. So when you see the Lobster Pound folks, they had to go through the process. And we also begin reaching out to vendors. So by this time, everything's pretty much set in place. The tents are up. The food is getting fried. There's lots of chaps and riding gear available, and it looks like it's going to be a great time for the 90th.
Well, and the weather's supposed to clear on Saturday, so that's always good for Bike Week. You know, I'm interested in what you said, John, that you've been getting ready since about December. A Union Leader article this week mentioned that as Bike Week begins, most participants and even local police were unaware that New Hampshire has a new noise ordinance, reducing the legal noise level to 92 decibels from 106. What are people talking about there in Laconia about this new decibel law?
Then exactly right. Then the city is ready for Bike Week on its level, but it certainly is not ready for, I believe it was HB 1442 that went into effect on January 1. And in speaking with our local law enforcement here, they were like, oh, yeah, there's been a change. But beyond that, there was no detail. And in speaking to one of my city councilors today who attends more police commission meetings than I do, she recalled that this has never been a topic of discussion at all.
Well, I think the quote... go ahead, sorry.
Then it creates some situations because, obviously, I don't think we're set up to do local enforcement because I believe you need a decibel meter and training and calibration, none of which that the city has done, to my knowledge.
Yeah, and in this Union Leader article that brought it to my attention, someone in Manchester's police department said, it's really hard to measure this, and I think someone in your police department, John, said, look, we are focused on arrests, you know, disorderly conduct, keeping the peace, and frankly, we've been doing a good job with that, and we're going to stick with that.
And they're absolutely right. Laconia also has a municipal noise ordinance, if you will. It's called a misuse of power ordinance.
Oh, I see.
And it basically precludes you in your vehicle on your motorcycle from using your engine as a brake. So those very sharp bone-rattling crescendos of motorcycles ramping up and slowing down. And obviously, the subjective kind of thing, and it's only a $100 fine if you're ultimately convicted, but it's on the books, and the police here do use it occasionally. Then that said, with the state's last decibel testing law that I was aware of, we conducted a test in downtown Laconia, and it was incredibly time-consuming, and it was incredibly consuming of municipal resources because you needed at least four officers to properly do it.
Wow, four officers. That's a lot, especially during Bike Week when you're worried about maybe more basic issues. And on that to you, John, the police chief in Laconia, I believe, was quoted as saying that he thought Bike Week had gotten a little tamer in recent years, maybe as part of New Hampshire's aging demographic. I wonder what you've observed.
Then absolutely right. I've had the opportunity to see 12 Bike Weeks, and each one is different, but there's also a general pattern that the chief has pointed out. And probably the best example of where Bike Week has matured, as even the organizers will admit, is that back in the day, up until about 2 or 3 years ago, we would shut down the Weirs Channel Bridge entirely to four-wheel traffic because of the crush of motorcyclists coming into that area. That hasn't been necessary. And it's still an opportunity that the police can avail themselves of, but now it's, you know, optional. It's not mandatory, and that's because the numbers are down specifically in Laconia, but also, as organizers have said for years, this has become truly a statewide event. So they come to Laconia for a little bit, but then they go up to the Mount Washington Valley, to the seacoast, and all over.
Well, John, thank you very much. Enjoy Bike Week.
Thank you for the courtesy.
All right, bye-bye. That's John Kajol. Again, he's a reporter for Laconia Citizen, updating us on how Bike Week is getting ready to kick off in Laconia on Saturday, the 90th Bike Week. Dean Spiliotis, did you have something you wanted to add in there?
Well, it was interesting, just in addition, listening to this decibel discussion, I remember when the legislature was first considering this. And, you know, the issue is that you're going to have people coming from all over the country on their bikes. They may not know that the local ordinance, my guess is, given that you want to maximize tourism and get people to come back, you're probably not going to fine them for, I mean, there may be some rare examples, but I don't think there's going to be any kind of comprehensive decibel check of exhaust pipes because it is so time consuming. Yeah, you know, Bike Week's interesting because there's this debate, this sort of fun debate in the state about, you know, which is more important for the state economy, Bike Week or the New Hampshire primary. You know, Bike Week brings in about a couple hundred thousand people, something like $100 million last year.
Wow.
So you could have four Bike Weeks, which is, you know, close to half, you know, sort of half $1 billion in revenue, and then one New Hampshire primary, kind of which is bigger. And I think the optimal thing would be to have candidates here who ride motorcycles, because then you can campaign and also help spur revenue growth through Bike Week.
All right. Well, good to hear from John Kajol again at the Laconia Citizen. And let's hear from our listeners now, gentlemen. The number 1-800-892-6477. And Sandra in Manchester is up. Hi, Sandra. Thanks for calling in on the Friday News Roundup. We appreciate it.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling out of concern about a possible refusal of Medicaid expansion in New Hampshire. My family's in a situation where we're in danger in the very near future, possibly losing our employer-provided health care. And we have a number of family members with chronic health conditions. Without health treatment, I could go blind in one eye. I have a daughter with ulcerative colitis that, if that isn't properly treated and it's expensive, she could become so bad off that maybe she couldn't even work and could end up with deadly cancer.
Wow.
I have a son with knee problems. The knee that has become severely dislocated 3 times. Without insurance, that's several $1,000s each incident and follow-up physical therapy. Without that, he could become crippled in that leg. The idea that politicians, because they are angry over the passage of Obamacare or because they want political donations their campaign or just for ideology, that they would make us wait a year or more to get that Medicaid expansion in New Hampshire just over politics at the risk of needless illness, pain, disability, and death for many New Hampshire citizens. That's very cruel, and if they do that, they should be voted out of office.
Well, Sandra, thank you for calling in, and good luck to you. Wow. I mean, tough stuff. And we did a whole program, like I said, on this issue of Medicaid expansion about a week ago. But to you, I think, Dan Tuohy, this gets to something you talked about earlier, people who favor Medicaid expansion trying to put a human face on it. And Sandra is certainly providing a human face to it.
Yes, she is. And thanks for the call, Sandra. You know, Senate President Bragdon did hear this when he went to his hometown of Milford earlier this week as well, and a number of people, including Paula Garby from Amherst, mentioned, you know, I have a son with CF or a loved one with CF. And, it's one of those things where you put a face to this. We aren't just talking about percentages and numbers here. There's real people here that is part of the debate, and it's part of the debate that will be continuing, even though the Senate voted against that yesterday.
Right. So I guess, Sandra, stay tuned. Couple next 3 weeks are going to show us what's really going to happen on this. Thanks for joining us. And another caller, this is Gina in Groton. Hi, Gina. Thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Sure. Yeah. And then I heard you talking about the wind farm.
Yes.
And so I was calling about that.
Sure.
So I just wanted to speak as a resident of Groton. A lot of us are very happy with the wind farm. We have no industry in Groton at all. So this was a big boon to the town. It brought our property taxes down significantly. And I've noticed a lot of the anti-wind signs in the area. There seems to be kind of a movement against it. But my observation is that there are a lot of towns that use their land, private and public, for various purposes, some of which I may not be happy about, but I don't go in and protest, let's say, the new McDonald's going in Plymouth, let's say. So I think Groton's a little bit too much of an easy target. We're a small town. And I just want people to kind of put it in perspective that there are all sorts of uses of public and private land that we may not like, but it's ultimately up to the landowners and the town. And I think Groton made a good decision for us. And
Gina, can I jump
like
in?
I'd like everyone to think about that.
Yeah, can I jump in and ask you a quick question? Because there's been a lot of proposals and so forth. So Groton, just remind us of the wind farm there, how big it is, what the name of it is.
As far as I know, it's just called the Groton Wind Project.
Yep.
And it's by a company called Iberdrola.
Iberdrola, right, the Spanish wind power developer. And how long has it been there, Gina?
I think it's only been fully operational for less than a year. They started putting up the towers maybe before that, but it's as far as I know, it's almost completely operational.
Okay. All right, good to hear from you because I did want to talk about that. So thanks a lot, Gina. And I did want to talk to you gentlemen about this. There were a couple developments concerning wind energy in the state. A proposed wind farm in Antrim was trimmed back in response to resident concerns. That's a proposal, not a done deal. And then in New Ipswich, the Site Evaluation Committee decided not to get involved, thereby allowing local opposition at the planning board to probably hold sway. Again, there's still some uncertainties. But Dean Spiliotis, what's the big picture here from these two local headlines about wind this week? And then folding into that, if you could, Gina's comments, you know, she likes it.
Sure. Well, you know, I think it goes to show you that whatever agreement there might be conceptually on the need for renewable sources of energy, that the reality of implementation is something very different. You know, as you mentioned, the Antrim project was scaled back by 10%. Instead of these having 10 500-foot turbines, you're going to have potentially 9 if it's approved. And then this new Ipswich wind farm, which looks like it's being scrapped, which is a much smaller farm. I think it was 5 towers. There's an example of where local planning trumped this statewide site evaluation committee. So, there are all kinds of issues now in terms of, you know, local control and local planning boards and zoning regulations versus kind of the statewide evaluation committee and its ability to either get involved or not get involved in a particular case. In the Antrim case, it was the statewide evaluation committee that denied the certificate to operate. So this is turning out to be a very complicated issue. And as Gina said, there are, for some towns, it's actually been a good thing. But I think it's going to be one of those issues that's going to be fought at the local level, and there's going to be a tension with local and statewide considerations. It just goes to show you that, you know, whatever attempts there are by the state legislature and the governor to have kind of a statewide energy plan, the devil's in the details, particularly at the local level when
right.
these local, you know, zoning boards. And Gina's point was interesting about, in her town, she's not going to go 30 miles away to protest at McDonald's in another town. That's just kind of the reality of grassroots organization. If your goal is to stop these farms, you're going to go for conservation reasons or what have you. You're going to go where the action is. And increasingly, that's in the towns and the local planning and zoning boards.
Did you want to jump in real quick, Kenny?
Yeah, just that, I mean, this is all about the ethos of New Hampshire. I mean, where do you put these turbines? You put them on hills. And what needs to be around that hill? Nothing. Because therefore you can catch the wind from the jet stream and generate. That's what developers are interested in New Hampshire. That's why they're looking at New Hampshire as kind of wind farm territory. Well, part of the brand of New Hampshire is there are beautiful hills with nothing around them. So I think a lot of people in this state feel like, I don't mind driving through Boston and seeing these huge white blades spinning around, but I don't want to look out my window at the beautiful hill with nothing around it and see that sight there. And that's really what is hampering a lot of these projects from moving forward.
Well, we talked earlier, gentlemen, a lot about House-Senate disagreements, especially on Medicaid. I wanted to spend a minute or two talking about a couple smaller items where they did agree. And Dan Toohey, to you first. They agreed this week that last call at New Hampshire bars should be allowed at 2 a.m. instead of 1 a.m. if communities want. If communities want. So Concord or Tilton or Laconia, they can decide. Why are they doing this?
Well, it's a bill that was sponsored by 3 state reps, I believe all from Manchester, all Republicans, just talking about, you know, bars and restaurants should have the option to be competitive, perhaps have a longer money rush at the end of the night. Perhaps just as an example, if there's a Verizon Wireless Arena event that gets out late, perhaps some
at 11 o'clock or 11:30.
Right, or people get off shift. I've worked late shift before, and you get out at 12:30 and like, well, but yeah.
We won't get into that now, Dan.
The key language that was added in the House agreed to was that on-premise licensees right now sell from 6 a.m. to 1 a.m. 7 days a week. The language that the House and Senate agreed to would be they may sail until 2 a.m. under conditions authorized by the legislative body of the city or town in which the premises are located. So there is that local control issue.
So Manchester, for example, has been trying to boost the nightlife of its downtown. So this could help. That's the thought there.
That's the idea, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I met up with the governor this past Wednesday, and she said with that local provision, she's inclined to support it. She's comfortable with the bill. The real question here is how many restaurants and bars will even go that route.
Yeah. All right. And another area where they agreed, and Governor Hassan did too, Kevin Landrigan, the white potato. Now the state's official vegetable. You know, sure, it's a cute story brought by some fourth graders. But why do we do this? Why do we have official fruits, potatoes, insects, you name it, newts?
I think part of it is about the state branding that we're very comfortable in doing. And it's certainly always been an opportunity for young people to get involved, in this case, fourth graders from a dairy school that did the research and determined that the white potato, at least from Ireland, had one of its origins here in Rockingham County. So I think that's the biggest reason why. And it's really tough to say no to a bunch of cute fourth graders coming here with a cute idea. I mean, that's what's always amazed me, is regardless of ideology, regardless of party, these legislators fall down in front of these fourth graders. They're no match.
All right. Well, and all of you, real quickly, because we're coming to the end. Dean Spiliotis, what are you going to be watching next week?
Obviously, watching the budget move to the conference committee, and also just watching this. We were talking about before the show, this incredible uptick in political advertising we're seeing on television.
Sure.
It's not even an election year right now, but it's become sort of the standard practice for advocacy groups to pressure legislators through advertising.
Okay. Dan Tuohy.
Obamacare. You know, Kelly Ayotte has a new page on our website asking grant assisters to express their concerns or ideas about the law. So I'm following up on that next week.
Yeah, and a new group called Citizens for a Strong New Hampshire is taking out anti-Jean Shaheen ads related to Obamacare. So I'm glad you raised that, Dan. Kevin Landrigan?
Really concerning this step with regard to the group and individual health care market and whether the state will retain control of it. It is related to the Affordable Care Act. Governor Shaheen wants this bill badly. The House Bill 660.
Governor Hassan
wants the bill badly. The Senate does not. It's as one of our emailers says, it's attached to a bill right now. And insurance companies are weighing in favor of it.
Okay. Lots to sort out, gentlemen. Thank you very much for being here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we begin with author Ben Hewitt and his new book called Saved, an exploration of the meaning of money and the concept of wealth. Next, we look at the charged debate over how electricity is supplied and who delivers it in New Hampshire. And later, we examine the spike in heroin use in the state and what doctors, police, and policymakers are doing about it. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.